what I intend to do today and tomorrow, which doesn't imply that you have to be here tomorrow, but if you are, you'll get, I hope, a more rounded picture. I want to have a discussion where I'll do most of the talking, but where you should be free to interrupt at any time. And in fact, I'm going to look for you to raise questions to which I'll try to respond after a bit. I want to have a dialogue about economic power, or another phrase would be monopoly power. I started off a series like this. I only gave one a week ago, Monday, and I put monopoly up on the board. And some people thought I was going to teach the game. Some people use the terms monopoly power and economic power interchangeably. One of the things I'll suggest this morning is that may be a little dangerous, that it may help to use words clearly so that we know exactly what we're talking about. But these sessions were inspired by a growing conviction on my part that the public is profoundly convinced that monopoly power or economic power or the power of giant corporations is a serious danger to the welfare of our society. I clipped an article that was, let's see, in the June issue this year of the Center magazine. You know what the Center magazine is? This is the official publication of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, which used to be in Santa Barbara and is now trying to conceal from its subscribers the fact that it's moved to Chicago. It's interesting that you can't find out from any of its publications that it is experiencing any difficulties or having any internal conflict. You have to rely on Time magazine. But the Center, you know, is devoted to dialogue among intelligent people about public issues. It's one of the propositions to which it is dedicated is that we can't rely on experts to solve our social problems. We have to count upon informed citizens to learn and discuss so that we can become masters of our own destiny. So when the Center magazine says something, that's often representative of intelligent and well-intentioned public opinion. So I was a little bit disturbed to see an article titled Corporation Logic, in which I find these statements. Here's one. Nearly all of our current crises are in one way or another connected with the untrammeled and encouraged growth of massive private monopoly, to the point where the economic machinery in every area is now profoundly susceptible to the moves of a very few giant firms. That is disturbing, if true. Or this, the typical American industry is one in which four or fewer firms control 60% or more of the business. Monopolized and oligopolized industry makes up most of the American economy. Only a relatively small segment remains in any sense competitive free enterprise. Well, I could multiply statements like that all over the place. I think that fairly well represents the state of public opinion. Most of the people who are concerned about monopoly or economic power don't express it quite that well. But I think the belief is widespread, and it's becoming increasingly widespread, that the economy and perhaps the government, maybe world governments, maybe the whole society, is in some sense at the mercy of some corporations' monopolies, not quite sure what, that have excessive power. If the public thinks this way, that's likely to affect policy, because our government is very responsive to public opinion. You may think not, but very often my friends at least complain that the government is unresponsive to public opinion. What they mean is that the government is unresponsive to that small segment of public opinion which they represent. When people they complain that the government will not do what the public wants, namely ban the automobile. I haven't noticed lately that that's what the public wants. Let's see. Let me ask you, what are some of the evils attributable to monopoly? What do you think? Are there? Yeah.
Well, there's a... First of all, there definitely are some... good things about
monopoly. No, I don't want to know the good things. I just want to know the bad things.
Otherwise, it would never have ever come into existence.
Okay, well, that's
the evils,
that's nice and Hegelian.
Having power concentrated in the hands of a few so that they can easily exploit the whole country, the whole entire structure.
Okay. I would like to make two comments on that. First of all, I think it's good that you brought up the point that the power is good in some sense, or they wouldn't have it. I think we have to be very careful. Opportunity to elaborate on that. Great report. That power is not a bad thing. It's not completely bad. It may be a dangerous thing, but without power, nothing is possible. You have power. You have power to walk over here, and you have power to get up and walk out. You have the power to speak and to love, and business executives have the power to organize resources. Corporations have the power to get things done. Without power, there is no life. There's no existence at all. So we want to be very careful in talking about power that we don't for a moment suppose that the ideal would be to abolish all power. What we want to abolish or maybe control or constrain in some way is power which is perhaps excessive in relation to its purposes, or which is not adequately constrained in the public interest. But so that your point is very well taken. There's a kind of conservative cast to the way you put it, that if they hadn't done some good, they really wouldn't be around. And that's kind of the old argument that, well, if it exists, it must serve some function. And if it serves some function, it must be useful. And if it's useful, it must be good, which is a valid insight. Maybe it's a conservative insight. It encourages you, though. It encourages you to stop and look at the reality which you're criticizing before you go lambasting it. But the other point, I noticed how delightfully vague your evils were. I don't know whether you can repeat what you said, but what I was looking for was some specific evils attributable to monopoly.
Price setting,
okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look at the production of goods, I think that quality control and suffering, there's no competition.
Mm-hmm. So if quality of goods is going down, as the monopoly problem gets worse.
Yeah. Well, and then they sometimes make their products so that they do wear down, so that they will...
Planned obsolescence.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of big business advertising and so forth are to the effect of government interference with big business is endangering the free enterprise. When in fact, when you have a monopoly, there's no such thing anymore as a free enterprise system, and all the ideas of competition and so forth that are supposed to stimulate your opponent into producing something better for a lower price, they're no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
And when those dangers, when those goodwill of the people who own Monopoly or whoever owns Monopoly, by their own goodwill, produce a good product for a low price.
Okay, so when you got competition, firms are compelled to produce good products at low prices. But when you have Monopoly, they're under no pressure and you have to depend on their goodwill. Can you name a single firm in the United States that does not face competition? Telephone company. Does the telephone company face competition?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's get rid of it, because the telephone company is regulated by government. Let's forget about public utilities. I'll come back in a bit to try to define some terms. I'll come back and use the example of the telephone company. But non-regulated firms that have not historically been under government regulation. See, your argument is essentially what's been used to regulate electric utilities and water companies where they aren't publicly owned and so on, railroads. But now, are there any non-regulated firms that do not face competition?
I don't think of any in the United States that I could use for an example, but I was thinking of a firm when I was thinking of De Beers Diamond Syndicate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, De Beers Diamond Syndicate. The Diamond Syndicate is the classic example. It's the most successful cartel, without any question. I think it's the most successful cartel that has ever been fashioned. It's been possible because the world supply of diamonds has come from South Africa and the Soviet Union, the other potential source, has cooperated. But now, does De Beers face competition? Granted that it's a successful cartel, or successful monopoly, whatever that means. I want to know if De Beers faces competition.
Are you asking from another specific producer or distributor?
Well, what are the people of De Beers worry about at night?
I think there's a competition that they would face in the sense of a kind of an opinion that maybe would say that their product was no longer necessary for the continuation of our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
So they might face competition, in other words, from changing lifestyle. People might decide that diamonds are not a girl's best friend, or that to give an engagement ring at the time of engagement is a stupid and a financially crippling custom. All right? So they do face competition.
They face competition from other gemstones.
From other gemstones. How about industrial diamonds? They do face competition, growing competition from industrial diamonds. So they face some competition, and now Paul, you reached for the best. I think that's one of the best
well,
examples.
Actually, I wasn't thinking in terms so much of competition, thinking in terms of pollution or something like that. Diamonds pollute so many women. That's why.
Yeah.
This is probably weak ground. I'm sure they probably hold it, but I just think it's an example. In the clothing industry, most of it, if you take men's suits, most of the men's suits are made by about 3 or 4 major producers. Now, there's competition between those producers to some degree, but most of the competition in men's clothing, by friends of Penny's company that understand this, most of the competition is among the retailers of this clothing. Mm-hmm. And the quality of men's clothing often at the retail level, especially for the masses of people, is not what it ought to be. It doesn't have to be. It can be mass produced. If you want to find real competition in good men's clothing, it means you have to go to a place where you're made for you.
So that means there is competition, as long as there are tailors.
How many people can afford that? Yeah. And I think that the suit producers know this.
Where did you get that figure that there are only 4 producers of men's clothing?
Well,
I don't understand. I know a town in Alabama. In that small town in Alabama, there are more than 4 producers of men's clothing, just in that one town.
Well, I believe
they all produce suits.
West Coast, we charge the West Coast distributorship for Penny's, who, not all of them, but there are about 4 companies who manufacture the, well, we go way back to who's responsible for the finances of this. There are about 4 companies who account for a large percentage.
All right, now you're shifting. Now there are four companies that account for a large percentage, but there are hundreds of companies that make men's clothing.
A large percentage of what is sold in the retail store to the majority of people are accounted for by mass producers who have, in many instances, bought out and sucked up smaller outfits that were competitive and had a corner on the market, so to speak. That is one example.
Now, notice how you're jumping. I'm going to be critical. You don't mind. You start off by saying that men's clothing was a monopoly, and then you said there were 3 or 4, and that's already away from monopoly, because monopoly means literally a single seller. And then you admitted that, well, it was just maybe suits, or she said it was just maybe suits.
I specifically use that example.
Oh, okay, just suits.
That's what.
And then you shifted to, well, they're the dominant producers. Now, and the question was, do you know of any seller that doesn't face competition? And if as you gradually explain it, if that's the way it is, there is competition in the selling of men's suits.
There's competition, but you're right. I mean, your question, I'm sure, is a hidden. There is nobody, probably, other than a cartel of some sort, doesn't have some competition, but it's the number and quality of competition that makes a difference.
Oh, by the way, you're working with competition. I'm not sure what you mean by it, as you raise the issue. Use it very simplistically on one hand and very sophisticatedly on another, essentially.
Well, he introduced the phrase, and I wanted to find out what people understood by it. If you ask a businessman, I don't think you will ever find a single businessman who doesn't insist that he faces competition, and vigorous competition. Now, he may be lying, but he's probably also correct. Why is it probably true that every businessman sees himself as facing vigorous competition?
Because he does.
Yeah, but why, Paul? What,
Well, he sees that cutthroat down the street. It should never have been born. Constantly giving worse service and undercutting prices and stuff.
Well, but so you're thinking of maybe the guy who's selling gasoline and sees all these gas wars breaking out, the dry goods merchant. All right, but
and
that's.
I was the only one that should have been in the lumber business. I always have been in the lumber business. Why those SOBs down the street? They should never have been there.
Yeah. Every businessman is competing for the dollar. Yeah. For. There's only so many dollars around. So he doesn't really think of himself in competition even with the same. The guy in the same industry is competing
right.
for the dollar.
Right. Now, that's a very, very important point. See, if you own a restaurant, you're competing with the baseball team, and you're competing with television and movies. So every businessman is competing for the dollar. And there are very few business firms that don't face seller, don't get into markets with other sellers of very similar products. So that's kind of what most of us would recognize as competition. Well, I still have to define the term. And then, of course, you're always competing with products that are somewhat like yours. And then, you know, so men's suits. Well, you don't have to wear suits. You know, if suits aren't stylish or go up too much in price, people will stop wearing them. They'll move to more casual kind of clothing. Because you're always trying to get people to consume more of your product rather than less of it. You're in competition in other markets, too. Like, often when the businessman talks about the competitive rat race, he's thinking of something like the labor unions with which he has to negotiate, or the difficulty of getting and keeping competent help, or the problems he has in renegotiating his loans with the bank because he sees himself as in competition with other people who want to borrow money, or difficulties he has in getting his suppliers to supply on time. Again, he sees himself as in competition with other people who are purchasing from those suppliers. So when the businessman says it's a competitive rat race, he may be fibbing a little bit, but it's probably true. And generally, you would say that a businessman who wasn't facing competition wasn't really making good use of his resources. You will face competition if you're a business executive because you tend to push your operation to the limit. And that's the point at which competition restrains you. In other words, suppose you're just building homes in a very tiny area and there are no other sellers around. Well, what you do is say, I wonder if I couldn't expand my operation. And as you expand your operation, you will eventually come into contact with other people who are also building homes, and then competition will begin. So everybody moves to the limits of his market, and at those fringes, he gets into competition with other people. So the diamond people push diamonds for more and more uses. They just start off with engagement rings, then they move into industrial uses, then they talk about the necklaces and bracelets, and maybe they want to eventually line the trail to Holden Village. Well, that would be pretty far down the road, but trail to Holden Lake. But the point is, if you're doing well, you always want to know, well, why couldn't I do better? And that lust, Marx would say, that insatiable lust for surplus value, tends to get them into competition. Somebody had a hand up. Yeah.
Well, there's some assumptions here. United States that sometimes don't hold in other companies or in other countries. I can think of one example. This is bicycle parts. There's a company in Italy, Campanella, that makes high quality bicycle parts, and you can never get them.
You mean you can't buy them in the United States?
You can buy them, but sometimes for certain parts you may have to wait a long time. Not always, but in some cases. I seem to get the impression that they have a certain number of employees who put out a certain amount every day, and they put that amount out and they quit. I don't think the owners are particularly interested in expanding because the demand is so high. They might be just content to sit on that security of knowing there's always going to be a demand for their parts and not be interested in expanding because they'll always have an income there.
Well, that's true.
Is that monopoly?
No, but that's not having to worry about competition because you'll always have a demand. It's a different way of not worrying about competition.
Mm-hmm. One way of not having to worry about competition is just not to worry. You know, Alfred E. Newman, who me worry?
They have a good product, a high quality product. They'll always have a demand for it, or at least in the immediate future. And people are all bicycle freaks now, and
yeah.
so they don't have to worry about the competitors. They're going to be playing for everybody.
Okay, yeah.
There's a very small scale operation in Boulder City, California, by two sisters who have a bakery. And every morning they bake so many things. And they have whole specialties, and their stuff is just luscious. And everybody comes down to buy, and if everything is gone, and we filled up. If there's still some stuff left at two or three, they're open then, and you can go ahead and get it. But they never have anything left over because they all these years of, you know, everything's gone by four, and they just go out the door, and the next morning they get just that much again. And I'm sure they make a very nice, comfortable living, and they always know it's going to be full, and they just don't worry about it.
That's how Marie Callender started.
Now, I doubt though that you would include these little sisters as a part of the problem of monopoly power.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Let me, as you correctly point out, I haven't defined some terms. I want to define some terms right now. I'm going to begin with competition, although I had intended to fudge that and just talk about monopoly. I'll tell you what I mean by competition, and you please don't argue about it. Think about it. No, it's what I mean by competition, definition of terms. It's a definition that's widely accepted by economists. But to understand it, you have to begin. We live in a world of scarcity. Scarcity simply means that there are some goods, matter of fact, an awful lot of them, where people can't have all they want without being required to give up something else that they also want. That's the meaning of scarcity. Something is not scarce when you can have all you want at no cost to you, and it's not scarce. Example would be unpolluted air up here in the mountains. You can breathe all you want. Get down to Los Angeles, can't always get it without incurring some cost. there aren't many free goods in the sense of non-scarce goods around. We live in a world of scarcity. But finally, too, in order to make use of goods, you have to use your time. And your time is scarce because you use it one way, you can't use it another. Okay. Given the fact that we live in a world of scarcity, where everybody can't have all he wants, we have to have some way of rationing, right? I mean, some way has to be found to parcel out the goodies that are there. Rationing implies some kind of discriminatory criteria. Now, there are all sorts of discriminatory criteria. An obvious one is money price. Now, that's the way we ration lobster. But another one is impoliteness. The most impolite get the most. Example. Who gets to save time after Vespers at the snack bar? Those who most discourteously elbow their way to the front of the line. Their little kids have a distinct advantage, don't they? Because they're not. So you watch. You look at the little kids. There are all kinds of places in our society where scarce goods are rationed to those who are fastest or strongest or most inconsiderate. And then other things. There are other scarce goods like prestige. Prestige is allocated on the basis of discriminatory criteria having to do with intelligence and eloquence and ability to hit baseballs a long distance and all sorts of things. All right? Now, competition, then, finally come. Competition is simply the effort to acquire the discriminatory counters. In other words, competition is the effort to qualify given the discriminatory criteria in which you're interested. Now, that makes competition pervasive. Competition exists everywhere. This morning I am competing for your attention. And I thought, on what criteria do you use? Well, I was aware of the fact that a little notice up there on the board would help. I'm also aware of the fact that talking to you rather than reading off notes helps. Looking around helps. Trying to pay attention to your faces and what you say helps. So, and you may say, well, what am I really after? I don't know what I'm really after, but I am aware frequently of that I am competing for your attention, paying attention to and trying to accumulate a mass of those discriminatory criteria which you use in allocating that scarce resource, which is your time and attention. Now, enough of that. You think about that. That works pretty well. That helps clarify a lot of things. Competition is pervasive through government. One of the distinctions that bothers me, because I think it leads to a lot of blunderbuss thinking, is the notion that there is a government sector and a competitive sector of the economy. Not true at all. Competition is pervasive in government. You know, politicians compete for office. Senators compete for committees. They compete with potential opponents for the favor of voters. Judges compete to write good decisions to get promoted to higher offices. They compete for public esteem. Regulatory commissions are competing like crazy with one another, competing for a share of congressional allocations. You can't understand the way in which our government operates if you assume that government is separate from the competitive sector. Now, monopoly, however. Monopoly means literally single seller. And it turns out that everybody is a monopolist. Every seller of a product is a monopolist if you define the term product narrowly enough. And no seller is a monopolist if you define the term broadly enough. So it all depends on how broadly you choose to define the term. Then the question becomes, how broadly should you define it? And the answer is, that depends upon your purposes. The important thing is to know what you're doing and to make other people clear about what you're doing. Let me illustrate. I want a quart of milk. How many sellers are there of a quart of milk? You say, well, gee, thousands. Yeah, but I live in Dallas. Okay, hundreds. Well, but I don't have a car. Oh, well, you could take a bus. Yeah, but that's too costly. And suppose we keep on going, and it turns out that it's 10 o'clock at night. The supermarkets are all closed. I don't have a car. The baby is screaming. And there's no one to leave the baby with. And I want milk. And there is only one store within walking distance. That store is a monopolist. It's the sole seller of the product I want, which is milk now, at a reasonable cost. So I am a monopolist. I am the sole seller of my particular brand of principles of economics to the students who have had the misfortune to register for my course. Monopolies, now, one of the things, you may be a monopolist for a while. And here's something to keep in mind. If that 7-Eleven store, that convenience store, which is my only option at 10 o'clock at night, if I get in there and I say, give me a quart of milk, and he says, okay, buddy, that'll be $7. I say, $7? He say, yeah, you want the milk? And it turns out, he's very shrewd. He knows that I would, if I had to, pay $7 to shut that kid up so I can go to sleep. He could get that out of me, but I would never come back. I would make better provision for the future. Moreover, if he did that too often, other convenience stores would move into the area. So, you have a monopoly for limited periods of time and for particular circumstances, and times and circumstances change. Tempus fugits. But now let's go to the other side. I said, I assume you agree, that if you define the product narrowly enough, every seller is a monopolist. If you define the product broadly enough, no seller is a monopolist. Now let's take Bell Telephone. Now, of course, there are regional telephone companies, and by the way, they're not all owned by AT&T either. So that if you don't like the way Southwestern Bell is treating you in Dallas, you could move to Garland. It's a town just outside of Dallas, which is served by General Telephone. And by moving, you could find a new seller of telephone service. You say, well, phooey, who's going to move just to get better service from the telephone company? Well, the answer is nobody's going to move in that direction, because the people out in Garland are requesting diligently that the Bell system take over their telephone company. It's usually what happens. But that really isn't quite so far-fetched. Businesses, at least, make their location decisions often on the basis of the kind of service that utilities provide. Why have electrical utilities advertised, come locate in the Mid-South, Mid-South Electric Company? They're trying to induce utility companies to move on the basis of the attractiveness of the electrical service that they provide. Oh, but that may be relatively trivial. Does Bell, let's say you're living in Dallas and Southwestern Bell is the only one that provides telephone service, and you're surely not going to move because your kids don't want to change school. Does Bell face any competition? Sure, it does. What are the competitors? If you define the product as communication services, that's really what it is. After all, we could get along without a telephone, couldn't we? People did for many years. Yeah, Bell is actually in competition with Western Union, the Postal Service, automobiles, fast running, loud yelling, you know, shutting your mouth. I mean, just count up the number of telephone conversations which wouldn't have to be made. So there are other products. The economist says there is no such thing as a perfectly inelastic demand, meaning that as the price of a product goes up, you can be sure that the public will consume less. Now, there may be a certain range over which that isn't true. I made that statement in a textbook, and one of the reviewers was a diabetic, and he objected. He said, no, you raise the price of insulin, and I will continue to take the same amount. And he said, nobody uses insulin except diabetics, and they will always take the same amount, whether the price is high or low. Well, suppose that's true. There still is going to be a limit, because if the price gets high enough for insulin, they wouldn't be able to eat anymore. They would have to spend all their income on insulin, and then they would starve to death. And I suppose there's no particular advantage in starving to death rather than going into a diabetic coma. And the point is that this is maybe an absurd example, a little bit cruel example, but when we talk about products that are basic necessities, people gotta have them, and no matter how much the price goes up, you know, they won't consume any less. We ought to be careful. I don't know any such products. You say, how about food? Well, the thing is, nobody buys food. You don't go into the grocery store and buy a pound of food. You buy a jar of peanut butter, a dozen eggs, and there are always substitutes. And you can substitute away from products whose price goes up. How about water? You know, water is a basic thing. You say, no matter how high the water company would put the price of water, people would have to drink water. Yeah, but most of the water people consume is not drunk. Only a tiny fraction of the water that we pay for on our water bills is drunk. If the price of water goes up, people are going to water the lawn less. They're going to wash the car less. They're going to make the kids stop playing with the hose. They're going to fix the toilet when it leaks and all kinds of things like that. Now, this is very important, because if people buy less of any product when the price goes up, whether that product is telephone service or milk, then no seller has the buyer completely over the barrel. And monopoly power, as I understand it, I just find this a useful way of thinking about it. Monopoly power means then the power of a seller to get the buyer by the throat. And that's always a matter of degree. It's just more or less by the throat. Now, that was a long attempt to clarify some terms, but I think it helps a lot. Now, if we go back to the question of how serious is the monopoly problem in the United States, I'd like to stay away from the men's clothing industry, because I've got some real difficulties with the data here. My understanding of the men's clothing industry and yours we're just far, far apart on what the facts are. I'd like you to think of some examples now. From your own experience, I mean, after all, you're a consumer, you think the monopoly problem is a serious problem. What are some of the products, what are some of the areas of your life in which you believe that sellers have substantial market power, meaning they've got, you don't have many good options so that they can really take you to the cleaners, and you are being taken to the cleaners?
American Medical Association.
American Medical Association, okay.
You don't count the companies that are regulated by the government.
No, let's leave those out for the moment. Yeah, yeah. I'd like to leave that out. Now, that raises, we can get into that maybe tomorrow. There are some real special problems. However, that forces me to make my speech on government, which I have. But let's take one. I'd like to do that. Let's just look briefly at one. Paul suggests the American Medical Association. Now, there's some doctors here. There's at least one I know.
I have a son-in-law who's a doctor. I did this in his honor.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because economists hate the American Medical Association. It's always been their favorite example of a wicked cartel. Economists are generally uneasy with labor unions, because labor unions, you know, are combinations in restraint of trade, and economists prefer markets in which individuals are competing. They're just easier to predict. The labor unions muss up the economist's tie to universe. However, most economists also are left liberal in their political inclinations. And it's uncomfortable to be left liberal and hostile to labor unions. So they resolve that problem by picking on the American Medical Association. But the American Medical Association is not even a seller of medical services. What it has been is an organization of physicians, which I think at the present time has about half the physicians in the country in its membership. Isn't it? About half.
Yeah. Merkin won't give a list of the names and the addresses of the other half.
You know, where can you get a list of names and addresses of the other half?
That'd be hard to do.
But what it does, is the American Medical Association responsible for the fact that when you go to the doctor, you have to pay $20 just to have him look down my throat and tell me there's nothing he can do to help me? Because it's only $20 for the first visit. That pays all the bookkeeping costs. Obviously, the American Medical Association does not set prices. State bar associations are a lot tougher on this. They've been successful in setting prices and in getting judges to enforce those prices. Happily, the antitrust division is now moving successfully against state bar associations, and realtors associations are next in line. I think that the realtors associations and the state bar associations have been significantly more successful than the American Medical Association in setting prices. But the American Medical Association has been able to do something else that the lawyers have not done. The American Medical Association has, over the years, been able to restrict the supply of doctors. The state bar associations haven't been able to do that very well, partly, it seems, because so many politicians and legislators are lawyers. And they kind of think that more lawyers is a good thing. It's a sort of crazy instinct that they have. It's a fascinating thing. Some people have tried to analyze. They say, look, given the fact that our legislatures, state legislatures, are full of lawyers, why don't they get together and impose ridiculously high entry conditions on new lawyers, and eliminate competition? But when you start talking to them, they sort of think that the law is such a sacred profession that they're kind of like ministers. They have the same attitude. Ministers don't realize that if they would restrict the number of seminaries, set very high entrance requirements, say you couldn't get in unless you had for 5 years led a morally impeccable life, insist upon a vow of chastity, that would restrict the supply, prices of ministers would go up. Well, it's just sort of strange idealism that operates there. But if you look at the history of the American Medical Association, it has occasionally made some very unguarded statements. Back in the 1930s, talking about the necessity of preventing physicians trained outside the United States from practicing in the United States. And now instead of saying, which would be the wise thing, the astute thing, that people trained outside the United States do not have adequate skills, the kind of skills which the American public has learned to expect and has a right to expect. Instead, they said, at a time when the incomes of physicians are falling, we cannot allow them. They learned, they've been more careful. But of course, it gets very complex. The supply of physicians has, the supply of medical care, by the way, that's something we're at. We're not really interested in the supply of physicians because there are physicians face competition outside of the area of physicians, don't they? One source is, just Dr. Spock's baby book. Another is putting up with it. Another is calling a friend. I have 5 children, all of whom have had at least their share of sore throats and earaches over the years, and I know that I do not always go to the doctor because there are costs. And by the way, the principal cost isn't the doctor's fee. It's the problem of getting an appointment, standing in line, getting the kid out of bed, overcoming his fears about the shot he's going to get, and all of that sort of stuff. So there are substitutes. And, of course, there could be far more substitutes. The possibilities for the development of paramedical care are enormous. There are all sorts of conservatisms and institutional rigidities that prevent these things from happening. But I've learned and been watching this in recent years and found that doctors and the American Medical Association, doctors especially, the American Medical Association, is this fair, Dave, is always considerably conservative than more conservative than doctors, would you say? politically, it's always several years behind the thinking of the doctors themselves. But their opposition to getting more medical care facilities out to the public, creating paramedical personnel, expanding the supply of doctors, seems to me to have significantly diminished. And I think one reason is that most of our trained, licensed physicians are overworked, and they would rather have less work and than more money. Is that the correspond with?
Yeah, that's a fair general statement. Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, now that was much too long. We can't do that with everyone. At the moment, and I, you know, obviously these aren't exhaustive analyses. What I'm trying to do, if you mention cases of which I know something, I'm just going to try to indicate the nature and perhaps limits on the quote monopoly power or market power of the groups mentioned. You mentioned one. What was that? Oh, oil. You mentioned oil. Did you want to? Is
I'm just curious. I think once today, if I have less, fewer options available to me in terms of the separation.
Yeah.
Gases.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It seems to say to me that there's some shift. In
yeah. When you, okay, when you, now, some people think that oil is, you know, obviously priced up to 60 cents. There's no competition there. They really have us by the throat. Now, you've got to be very careful with the oil industry because it's at least three different industries. There's a production industry. There's a refining industry, and there's a marketing industry. And maybe you could toss, well, maybe possibly you want to toss distribution in there too, the whole jobbers and transportation business. But there's at least production, getting the oil out of the ground, refining, and marketing, where, you know, that's what you run into is the marketing end of it, the retailing. Now, retailing is the most competitive business you can imagine. Anybody says that a seller of gasoline, retail gasoline sellers, have the customer by the throat. I just don't know what he's talking about.
Some companies have other companies by the throat.
Well, where is the level? Now, where is the, is it in refining? There are an awful lot of refiners in this country. Awful lot of refiners.
Our refining capacity is below what it really should be if our production goes up.
That's true. We don't have as much refining capacity like people would like. But that's not because they've been restricted. Actually, the oil companies, the refiners, have tried to build additional refining capacity for some years and have been stymied partly by the environmental movement.
Didn't production have?
Well, production is more competitive than refining. I mean, there are more producers of oil just within the United States than there are refiners of oil.
What drives up the supply, I guess is my question.
The Arabs.
Why does the independent go?
Okay, why are the independents going out of business? In order to understand it, you first have to understand why so many independents appeared. Let me see if I can give an overly simplified example. Refining, you know, is a process that produces a lot of different products. Let me just boil it down to two. Suppose we're living in the Chicago, Illinois area, where there are a lot of refineries up there, a lot of people, and you get cold winters. Well, in the summer, people drive their cars a lot and buy a little fuel oil. In the winter, they drive their cars much less and buy a lot of fuel oil. So the refiners want to produce a lot of gasoline in the summer and very little gasoline in the winter. So they have to, they can alter their mix, but they can't just get gasoline out one time and just fuel oil out at the other. Some fuel oil will be a byproduct of gasoline production, and some gasoline will be a byproduct of fuel oil production. Well, this gives them serious storage problems, so that when the winter comes, it's long about December, January, they find themselves, the refiners in the Chicago area, find themselves with huge quantities of gasoline. Their storage facilities are full. So they turn to jobbers, and they say, hey, would you mind taking a few million gallons off our hands? And the jobber says, well, why should I? I can't sell it. And people aren't, I got enough. And say, well, look, we'll give you a cut rate. they've got to cut the price to get rid of it. The jobber takes it and stores it, holds it, which there's a cost of that to him, because he gets it at a cut rate, and that price has to be cut enough to persuade him to hold. Now, he's got the same problem. Then he fills up, and what does he do? He goes to those storage places that are scattered all over the city called gasoline stations, which have enormous tanks underground. He says, hey, why don't you load up? Why keep your tanks half full all the time? Well, keep them full. I said, why should I? I don't have that much business. I'll give you a cut rate. And so, and then, of course, what does the gasoline station do? It has the same problem. It tries to persuade all the customers who are carrying 20, 25-gallon storage containers around with them to go full. You know, think of what a difference it makes in the city of Chicago if everybody drove with 2 gallons in the tank versus if everybody drove with a full tank. Think how much storage capacity there is moving around the city of Chicago, which you induce people to use by giving them a cut rate. And when gasoline prices are real low, isn't it true, when the gas war is on, you always drove around with a full tank. You top it out to make sure, because it might go up tomorrow. When prices are high, you let that gauge get way down, you may even run out of gas. Well, now, it was in this context that the independents developed all over the place. They were people who could come in here and take advantage of the fact that there were periodic surpluses of gasoline. Now, that it's there's more to it than that, but that is one of the large levers that they used to become so important in the industry. Well, with the increasing scarcity of, with increasing shortages of petroleum products caused by price controls, because if you took off the price controls, there wouldn't be any shortages. It would still be scarce, but there wouldn't be shortages. The price would rise enough to persuade enough people to stop using it so that the quantity supplied would equal the quantity demanded. But with the price controls held down, nobody's got any excess. And the independents just can't get product. No conspiracy involved here. After all, if Standard of Indiana has been for years supplying gasoline to all sorts of independents and to its own brand name stations and been selling it to its own brand name stations at a higher price, but using those independents to get rid of this surplus, handle its storage problems, and suddenly it runs out of storage, who's it going to cut off? Cut off the independents.
There's a lot of talk today that there's not simply a matter of supply and demand, it's regulating the market.
Mm-hmm.
As I recall, the Senate just launched some investigation of why producers produce less this particular May than they did a year ago, or some such.
Oil producers, you mean? Or, I mean, gasoline refiners?
I'm not sure where it is. My data is lacking. But Church or someone, is Senator Church, is going ahead with this. And there's some pure collusion. In the
production. Yeah. Well, I don't know. The fact that Congress launches an investigation doesn't really prove anything about problems.
True.
You know, congressmen launch investigations for all sorts of reasons, including upcoming elections. Okay. Well, does somebody want to say something? Again, where I'm not. My analyses of these industries certainly are not exhausted. I'm just trying to suggest some things because I want you to think about. Monopoly sellers, that is. What products do you buy where you think you're really they've got you by the throat? Who's got you over the barrel? Because I finally think that that's what the monopoly problem comes down to. If it's a problem, it's a problem because somebody's got too much power over us.
Sugar market.
Just a second. He had it.
How about the automobile industry to a certain extent? Because people, lifestyle, demand they have to have a car to get to the store, to get to school, to get wherever they're going. They can't decide not to buy a car because they'd be stuck in the suburbs somewhere to a certain extent. Automobile is a large population by the show.
Of course, now notice that the automobile industry never sells you a car. General Motors does, Chrysler does, Ford does. And you do have options. You've got a lot of options. In fact, the American manufacturers have discovered in the last couple of years that the public has far better options than they realized.
Therefore, had an import duty imposed, now makes my detail be much more expensive.
But the import duty isn't the principal reason for the increase in price of your VW. The principal reason is the devaluation of the dollar relative to the mark. That's the main part of it. Yeah, right. The import duty on VW, I think, ought to be abolished. And there's an example where the government is helping sellers to keep you by the throat by restricting foreign competition. Always been popular.
Of course, it's the labor unions that want the import duty, not the manufacturers.
Not true. The manufacturers went right along with that. Yeah, the labor unions want it too, very definitely. Labor unions have an interest in preserving their jobs. But I think, you know, the automobile manufacturer, even if the automobile industry has us by the throat, and I'm just not sure what that means because, you know, I don't deal with the automobile industry. We're still discovering how many options people really do have, how rapidly people can change their lifestyles. And of course, if the price of automobiles goes up and is expected to remain high or continues to rise over a long period of time, people are going to do an awful lot of things that will sharply reduce the amount of automobiles they produce. So, you know, I've had this experience a number of times. It's kind of funny, you know, but I'll say to people, look, let's cite a typical American industry. And it's amazing how often people come back with automobiles. It's not a typical American industry. It is one of the most highly concentrated industries in the country. And I think it's significant to reflect on the fact that so many people think of automobiles as the typical industry. It is not typical. There are basically four American manufacturers of automobiles. They produce something like 98% of all domestically produced automobiles. And that is in no way typical of the American economy. That concentration ratio is far higher than the average. And the automobile companies were John Kenneth Galbraith's favorite example of how corporations really have us by the throat. They can just make any profits they want to make. You know, and I just happen to have before me here the Fortune July report on corporate profits and sales. It's interesting to note what happened to the automobile manufacturers. General Motors last year dropped out of first place in sales.
Replaced by
Exxon.
Exxon.
Yeah. Well, all the oil companies moved up. But see, Exxon for years had larger assets, but the smaller sales, meaning that General Motors was making the bigger profit. But General Motors has General Motors has been averaging 20% over 20% return on original investment for years and years and years. See, they're down to 7.6% last year.
Where is Exxon?
Exxon was 20%. But Chrysler, or Ford Motor Company, made 5.8%, way below the national average for manufacturing. And Chrysler Motor Company took a loss. So those are those giants that can do anything they want. Now, Galbraith argued that not only are they powerful in their own right, they've got government ready to do their bidding. So nothing evil could ever happen to the automobile industry because the techno structure won't allow it. I think we've seen in the last year that if the techno structure exists, and if the techno structure does indeed intend to protect the automobile industry at all costs, then the techno structure is pretty powerless. It hasn't protected the automobile industry.
Do you think that's harmful that the automobile industry, as an industry, should be that important?
Well, I think it is, Eric, but that's because I have a deep-seated prejudice against automobiles. But it's a reflection. I think we should write it. It is a reflection of the tastes of the American public. Now, I don't know. You may disagree with this. A lot of people think that Americans are addicted to the automobile because they've been brainwashed by advertising. I just don't believe that for a minute. I think we've been brainwashed by one another. I don't think that a 14-year-old kid, is chomping at the bit to get his driver's license, and as soon as he gets to be 16, is saving to buy his own set of wheels because he's been watching TV. He's been in love with the automobile since he was a toddler, ever since he saw his daddy step on the gas and gun it. It's been a process of socialization. I think it's important to recognize that, because if it's a process of mutual socialization, then there's no villain. We all done it to ourselves.
I don't think a lot of kids are waiting to buy a car. They're waiting for their parents to give them one.
Well, but if their parents won't give them one, by golly, they think they're going to buy one.
Would this confuse the conversation if you threw in here the increasing talk of the monopoly in education?
No, not at all. Is there a monopoly in education? I'm glad you brought that one up, because I think that is one of the most dangerous monopolies in the country. Now, again, notice, there are lots of schools, there are lots of people selling educational services, but some of them really have us by the throat. You have no choice but to send your child to school. You can't, effectively, you can't teach him at home. They'll get you. Under most state laws, they'll nail you for having an inadequate lunch program or something. Or not having enough hours of phys ed. Now, from whom can you buy? They don't say you have to buy from the state. But if you don't buy from the state, you pay twice. You pay double price. So, but then you can't even choose among all the state schools. You've got to send him to the school in your district. So in effect, you are required by law, except at very, very high cost, to turn your child over to some principal and a set of teachers whom he designates for imprisonment during the hours of 9 to 3:30 or whatever. Now, I'm serious. I'm not joking about this. I think that is the basic explanation for the low quality of our educational system.
Well, the education varies with where you're at, too, though, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like a school in Beverly Hills is going to be better than one in Watts.
Right, because people in Beverly Hills have more money and they're willing to pay people to use their influence to improve the school. Oh, they also have more education and they are more interested in the school. And also it's attractive to live and teach in Beverly Hills so they can get better teachers. So there are all kinds of things. Sure, the quality differs. But I'm not too concerned about the people who live in Beverly Hills. I'm concerned about the people who live in Watts. I'm also concerned about my own children. Most middle class Americans who don't have any options.
There are some people in educational finance today who are saying that unless society changes its method of financing education, all independent higher education will die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, notice that independent lower education is almost dead now. Independent primary and secondary education, the Catholic schools, which were the largest bastion yet of non-elitist, I mean non-financially elitist elementary and primary education, are going down the tubes for financial reasons. And now the private schools, the private colleges and universities are in deep and growing financial trouble. Not all of them, the very elite ones are still doing well. They complain that they can't make their budgets either, but that's because their budgets are ridiculously inflated. Surprising number, if you don't follow the figures, of private colleges are closing every year. I'm cutting back services, and of course, if they cut back services, the quality of their product relative to the state product becomes less. And we are drifting toward another state monopoly in higher education. Seems to me to be totally unnecessary. What would be a way to break this monopoly? What would be a way to ensure that we have more competition in the provision of educational services?
Voucher system.
Uh-huh. Voucher system. If the state wants to subsidize education, why doesn't it subsidize the student instead of the school? In other words, give each student a voucher, which he can cash at the school of his choice. And why create this enormous bureaucracy and feed money into that? The answer is that when the government passes out subsidies, the people who are most effective at getting the subsidies are not the consumers, but the producers. So most subsidies go to the producers, and then the producers say, "Come unto me." Thou hast no choice, because I persuaded the government to collect your tax revenue, and now I will sell you the service on my terms.
Actually, the middle class is hurting more than the lower class or the upper class, because the lower class will get a lot of subsidy from the state or from the government, but the middle class doesn't get these extra monies coming in for extra curriculum. So I think middle class schools are suffering more than the other two.
We don't get too far off into the subject of schools, but I'm glad that one came up, because you see the variety of products and services which we purchase and the variety of the enormous range in the opportunity sets that we face. You know, sometimes we've got a lot of good choices. Sometimes we have very few good choices. And what I'm encouraging you to do right now is to think of monopoly as situations in which products or services that you buy are sold to you and you don't have many good options. Are there any other examples you can think of?
What about sugar?
Yeah, what about sugar? Well,
it's in the hands of a few major producers.
Yeah, sugar is in the hands of a few major refiners.
Right.
Refiners, because the growers are tremendously competitive. The evidence that satisfies me that they do not have substantial market power is the extraordinary sensitivity of their prices to changes in underlying conditions of overall demand and overall supply. You know, when the price of sugar last year ran up, 600% in a year or something, there was, of course, as there always is, a lot of screaming about the monopolists. And people noticed that there are just a few sugar refiners. But, of course, when the price of sugar went tumbling back down, people didn't say, "I take it all back, it isn't monopolist at all." We've had these. We've had this before. About 63, there was a big run-up in the price of sugar associated with the cutoff of relations with Cuba.